Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to the ninth newly recorded episode of Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work in 2017. I'll be joined today by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author David K. Johnston, who's covered Donald Trump off and on for 27 years, including breaking the story in 1990 when he claimed to be worth $3 billion but could not pay interest on loans coming due, and his bankers actually put his net worth at minus $295 million. In his 2016 book, The Making of Donald Trump, Johnston profiles the many ways Trump has gotten wealthy by bilking others, colluding with criminals, evading prosecution, romancing the press. Johnston won his Pulitzer for New York Times reporting on loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code, and so we're going to also talk with him about taxes, Trump, and where we go from here. After hosting and producing the show weekly for 17 years, I stepped aside from recording new live interviews. But since then, I've dug into the archives to stream one of the relevant earlier interviews each week on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts of years of interviews are available to listen to anytime, anywhere on iTunes, Podomatic, or at my site, terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. And following the election of Donald Trump, however, I could no longer resist exploring the path forward and confronting him and his administration, and thus these new interviews. On this show, we've always explored the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work, based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. So before I bring David K. Johnston in, I want to offer you a few websites for information on how to actively participate in the resistance to Trump and the movement toward a healthy, progressive future that we so desperately need. And you can email me at T.E. McNally, T.E.M.C.N.A.L.L.Y., T.E. McNally@mac.com to get these websites and more. IndivisibleGuide.com. One word, Indivisible Guide, that's probably the top one. OurRevolution.com is the organization founded by Bernie Sanders and his campaign. MoveOn.org, which while it had for years been primarily an online organizing tool, has seen since the election that they've got to integrate more fully with grassroots things on the streets and in town halls and so on. So MoveOn.org. FiveCalls.org is one which at any time will tell you five calls that you could make to make a difference and influence policy. And TownHallProject.com tells you when your representatives, during their breaks usually, might be holding a town hall so that you can go and hold their feet to the fire. And in the state of California, good organization, couragecampaign.org, couragecampaign.org. As I said, you can email me if you want more information on resistance to the Trump administration. Now to today's guest. When David K. Johnston was 19 years old, the San Jose Mercury News hired him as a staff writer. And his investigations over the next four decades appeared in that paper and the New York Times, as well as the Detroit Free Press, the LA Times, the Philadelphia Inquirer. He exposed LAPD political spying and brutality. He revealed news blackouts and manipulations that forced a six-station broadcast chain off the air. He solved the vicious murder by confronting the real killer and winning freedom for the innocent man, for the innocent man who'd been accused, and explained the economics of former GE chairman Jack Welch's retirement perks, prompting Welch to relinquish them. And in late 2016, he founded DCReport.org, DCReport.org, an online journal covering the president's administration and the Congress. His books include Temples of Chance, How America, Inc. Bought Out Murder, Inc. to Win Control of the Casino Business. So you can see how he initially crossed paths with Donald Trump. Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. Perfectly Legal, the covert campaign to rig our tax system to benefit the super rich and cheat everybody else. The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. And his latest, The Making of Donald Trump. Welcome once again, David K. Johnston, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Well, Terrence, thank you for having me.
Okay. And as you may know, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So I've just laid out, you know, highlights of your story. But in your vision, in your words, can you tell us briefly how you see your path to the work you do today? And feel free to mention mentors or turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
Well, when I was a kid growing up in Santa Cruz, California, I needed a job. I got married when I was 17 years old, and the local weekly newspaper hired me to cover the city council and the school board. And I sat there doing long division because there were no pocket calculators back then, and would simply, you know, figure out the local budgets and started writing about them. And the next thing I knew, you know, I'm driving in the morning, and the NBC affiliate in San Francisco is reading my stories on the air because I took this stuff that's designed not to be understood by people and put it into plain English. And simple things like telling people your property tax will go up next year, not by some average amount for the average house worth a certain amount, but so much per $1,000 of value in your house. And little things like that, just that's what got me started.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I know about your career, and if you want to, and I'd like you to speak to it, is that although, as I pointed out, you've been associated with the Detroit Free Press, the, obviously the San Jose Mercury, later the Mercury News, the LA Times, Philadelphia Inquirer, the New York Times, you also have kept yourself fairly independent. Talk about that choice and how that path has been.
Well, in every job that I had after the Mercury, where I was learning my craft, and I was there for 4.5 years. Basically, first of all, I've only applied for one job in my life. Everybody's always come to me, including the New York Times, with one exception. And the deal I made was, I'm going to do what I want to do. I have lots of things I can offer you, and if you don't like this that I want to do, I'll give you something else. But you don't tell me what to do. Now, that approach, in the long run, wears out your welcome. And writing about big subjects wears out your welcome. When Bill Thomas was the editor of the LA Times, in many ways he put out a very good newspaper, but he had no stomach for local investigations unless they went after powerless little people. And certainly he didn't want to seriously examine, as I did for 3 years, the Los Angeles Police Department and the myths around it. And he hauled me into his office one day and said, I don't think you realize there's not a single important person in California who hasn't complained about you. And I said, well, Bill, do they ever say one of my facts right? And he says, you're not getting the point. And I said, probably not. And it was not long after that that I made my only job application, which was to the Philadelphia Inquirer, so I could go write about the casino business in Atlantic City and get out of the LA Times.
Okay, yep. And so you more than a lifetime employee of anybody, you are a lifetime investigative reporter.
Yes, and one of the things I've done different from my peers, I mean, I'm the former president of our association, which has 5,700 members, investigative reporters, so I always would break off now and then and write light features, because if you only do investigations all the time, it messes with your head. So I wrote pieces in the past about things like factories in Los Angeles and elsewhere that had art on the walls done by the employees, and making homemade paper making, you know, artisan paper making. I did that maybe 40 years ago, and other things like that to sort of keep, you know, my head in balance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so how and why did you come to write The Making of Donald Trump? What led you to that decision? Because I know when you did it fast.
Yes. Well, in 2012, when Trump announced again that he was running, he was treated very seriously by all the political reporters, and only Lawrence O'Donnell of MSNBC and I said, this is nonsense. He's running for a new contract with NBC. And when Trump then announced he had to stop his campaign because, much as he wanted to be president, his television show needed him, you know, we were proven right. Well, when Trump announced on June 16th of 2015 that he was running, I watched this live on TV and immediately said, he's serious this time. And I set out writing pieces to try to alert my fellow journalists to who Trump is, because he is the most masterful manipulator of journalists that I have ever known. I wrote a whole number of pieces, including one called 21 Questions for Donald Trump, and another one called 14 Questions for Donald Trump, directly aimed at journalists and saying, you need to ask Trump about the major international drug trafficker he risked his whole fortune to show his loyalty to, his involvement with big mafia, with Russian mobsters, with swindles, with cheating workers. And all of those questions and articles that I posed, only two of them were ever asked, one by Marco Rubio and the other by Ted Cruz. Mm. Journalists utterly failed to do what's called a scrub of Trump. I was on the phone one day in the fall of last year with one of my former editors at the New York Times, and I was complaining that, you know, Trump was not being investigated, and I was hammering on this big drug trafficker. And my book, I point out that I don't know what was going on there, but the obvious question to ask Donald Trump is, were you financing this man's drug deals? And the editor said to me, when was this? And I said, basically 82 through about 86, 87. And he goes, oh, my goodness, that's 30 years ago. We're not going to go into that. Well, that Sunday, the New York Times had a huge front page story about what Hillary Clinton was doing in the 1970s. And I think the reason for that Trump was not looked into is this requires, first of all, a lot of skill and knowledge of the law to be able to write about his connections, and a lot of digging old things out of government records, although I made available, I have tens of thousands of pages of Trump documents, and I made them available freely to everybody who asked. I got a lot more requests from foreign journalists and a lot better questions from foreign journalists than American journalists, by the way. And so as we got closer to the election, once it became clear Trump was going to get the nomination, as I had said I thought could happen, a publisher came to me and said, can you do a book in a hurry? And because I had written all this stuff, I could. In a month, I cranked out this book, The Making of Donald Trump, which is now sold in 10 or 11 languages all around the world. It was a New York Times bestseller. But interestingly, we've sold more copies outside the United States than in.
Okay, let me ask about a couple of things you said there. First of all, when you one thing you trace in your writings and is that Trump has been flirting with running for president or talking about flirting with running for president since the 80s, correct?
Since 1985, that's right.
And yet you in 2012 said he's not serious. In 2016, you said he was serious. Did something change about Donald Trump, or did something change about what you sensed in the electorate?
No, what I sensed was that there was no clear Republican nominee. Remember, the field at one point had 17 people, and we and many of us referred to them as the clown car.
Right.
And this was exactly the kind of place that Trump would like. You know, there was a West Wing episode in which the fictional president, Jed Bartlett, says, I'm not supposed to be here. The only reason I got here is so many people were running. If I won 6% of the vote, it looked like I was a winner. And Trump intuitively understood that he didn't need to make a great showing. He just had to pick off opponents mm-hmm. and be credited with picking off the opponents.
Mm-hmm.
And he also understood television. So Hillary Clinton would give, and this is not an endorsement anyway of Hillary Clinton, it's just a factual statement. Hillary Clinton would give serious talks with serious proposals. Bernie Sanders would give talks in which he would raise very important issues. But Donald Trump is like an auto accident. You know, we all rubberneck when we see an accident on the highway. Except his auto wreck came with a marching band, dancing girls, and fireworks.
Yeah.
And the TV people quickly learned that as long as they had Trump on, people kept glued to the TV, and when they cut away from Trump, people turned off their televisions. And so he got this uncritical coverage.
Yeah, uncritical and free.
Yes, I mean, it was certainly his specific points were criticized. I don't want to be too broad about
right.
that. But no digging into his thoroughly documented background. Every fact about Donald Trump's criminal connections and misconduct is sourced in my book to a public record, or Donald's own writings or his own books. And I even put my email in the book and said to people, if you find a mistake or don't understand something, get in touch with me. No one in the world has shown a single error in that book except for some typos in the first couple of printings.
Right, and you have 44 pages of notes, and is the book 288 without the 40, or does that include the 44?
No, it includes that. I mean, the book is relatively short.
Yeah,
you can read it in 4 to 5 hours.
Right, so the book is about
how quickly you read.
So the book's about 240, 244, and then 44 pages of notes.
Yeah.
And so
right.
That's the sourcing, the record, and as you say, no one has called to contradict. The next question was two that have to do with the media, which obviously is a huge part of the story, both in his campaign, in his election, and obviously in his presidency. And half the time, he's the one that's making it a story. Why, in your judgment, is there a better reception, a more curious reception overseas than in the U.S. for this stuff? And if you want to refer, this clearly was not the case with Hillary or Bill Clinton.
Right. Well, you know, in thousands of schools in America, we have stopped teaching civics. I'm astonished at the number of young people, young adults I have met, who do not understand at all how our Constitution works. And many of these are school districts that, by God, they're going to keep football. But we don't need to teach civics. What do students need to know that for? I mean, it's a democracy. It'll take care of itself. And I've long observed that I have had much better conversations about culture, economics, policy, much more sophisticated conversations with random people, waiters, truck drivers, cabbies, cops, that I have met in rural Slovakia, Norway, Canada, Singapore, than sitting next to executives in the first class section of an American aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had a real serious breakdown in this country because our education system is designed to produce compliant drones for factory work and office work. The Europeans in particular do a much better job of teaching critical thinking skills.
Yeah, let me just tell you briefly. I remember, just because your reference brings this up, I interviewed Antonio Damasio, a neuroscientist who's done great work, born in Portugal, currently at USC. At the end of an hour interview on his latest book, he said, as soon as we got off the air, he said, "Wow, that felt like a European interview."
Yes.
And
well, I've been on the primetime news in New Zealand, Australia, Japan, Canada, Britain, France, Germany, and some other countries. But what's in my book has never had a word of mention on ABC, NBC, CBS. And when I was interviewed by PBS, they specifically told me not to say anything about Donald Trump and criminal activity. And I did anyway, and they edited all of that out.
So now your original thing was civics is failing. The level of curiosity and intelligence among the populace is failing.
I don't think it's intelligence. I think it's where we focus people's interest.
Right.
You know, lots of people who can take the latest squeeze play in a baseball game
exactly.
and dissect it
yep.
with extraordinary skill.
Yes. Yes.
When you turn to politics, it's astonishing how uninformed they are.
Right.
That's not stupidity. That's where your heart is.
Very good. But so that's the populace. But why the media? I mean, and you say you actually served as president of the Investigative Reporters. What's gone wrong with the media? Is it merely follow the money?
No, I mean, I think there are a bunch of things. First of all, you know, there's been a 40-year highly financed campaign to attack honest journalism. And there are large segments of this country where people will pay no attention to any of the reliable mainstream news organizations, both on the left and the right, because of all these attacks. There's an old saying, doctors bury their mistakes, lawyers see theirs off to jail, only reporters sign theirs on the front page for everyone to read. And despite a long track record of correcting mistakes, and, you know, it's the first draft of history, there are lots of mistakes along the way, the major news organizations pretty much get it right. But in this case, there was tremendous pressure brought. Trump threatened to sue everybody. I mean, I've written stories, Terrence, accusing people of committing murders and exposed spies and foreign agents. The second most heavily edited article of my life was a piece for Politico magazine that simply recounted the public record on Donald Trump's many, many, many involvements with mafia.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I couldn't believe how much this was lawyered. I mean, I demanded they pay me a bigger fee before I'd let him publish the article because
of all the extra
all
work
the,
you had to
the
do.
The work the lawyers demanded.
Yeah.
And I've had several news organizations have said flat out they would not report on my book because Donald Trump threatened to sue them.
So, okay, that does seem to be there's an answer. So it isn't just that that they, as I said, they were willing, and as you pointed out, they were absolutely willing to always write about the supposed or alleged scandals of the Clintons, but not of Trump. And the difference
right.
is his approach to them.
Well, and also, you know, one of the other faults here was every time Donald Trump would talk about Hillary Clinton's emails, I ask people all the time, well, what is it you think was in those emails? Oh, well, she was doing corrupt things. And I go, well, like what? Well, I don't know, but I mean, why did she delete them? And I said, well, she didn't delete any. They were deleted by professionals at the State Department, and the ones that deleted were things like communications with her daughter about her wedding dress.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there were fights with Bill Clinton. I can't imagine Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton ever having, over the email, nasty words to say to each other. Things like that were what were eliminated. And by the way, we know that the State Department's email system and the State Department's whole system was hacked, but the FBI director, James Comey, said that there is no footprint on the computer of Hillary Clinton used in her home for her email that it had been hacked. And hackers leave footprints. So the best evidence is she wasn't hacked, contrary to what Trump said that was repeated and repeated and repeated. I mean, Donald understands if you tell something often enough, people forget about what the real issue is. They just get this message he wants, which is she's a crook. And Donald projects. When Donald Trump tells you she's such a crook, she shouldn't be allowed to run for office, he's talking about himself.
Of course. Of course. And by the way, that reference to telling the lie repeatedly was even clearer in the original German, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Okay. You also point out, so he said part of it was the threat of litigation, the threat of harassment, all of that sort of thing. But you also say that he is the best manipulator of the press that you've ever seen.
Right.
People have a good sense
of
it.
Here's one of Donald's best techniques. He wants to get a story out that isn't true. And one of them I tell in my book is when he claimed that he was having affairs with Madonna, Kim Basinger, and Carla Bruni. The first two he'd never met, and the third one has called him a lunatic and did so at the time. So what does he do? He gets the New York Post, Rupert Murdoch's New York Post, to publish this. Once somebody has published this, then everybody else will write about it. And he understands that. So he goes to places where they don't care about the facts. They never let the facts get in the way of a good story. And he gets a story out there. And then everybody goes and says, the New York Post said this. And then eventually they quit saying that and they just say he did these things. And when it comes out that none of that's true, well, you know, it's me and a handful of other people who write about it, but it doesn't make big news.
Yeah, it's not news. And the other thing he does also, it seems to me, is once it's been put in the Post, he will talk about it. And as if, I mean, it seems to me many, many times he'll say, well, everyone says, someone's saying, they're saying. And
oh, yes.
And
so, well, that's another thing Donald does all the time. He says, everyone knows this or everyone says that.
They're all saying this.
And, of course, this can also cut against him because after he became president, you know, he said, who knew health care was so complicated?
Yep.
And hardly anybody knew Abraham Lincoln was a Republican. And finally, now, after he's in office, he has begun to say things that reveal one of the key points of my book. Donald Trump is appallingly ignorant. He literally doesn't know anything.
Right. And it's, just at this right moment, since you brought that up, point out when you first started the investigative reporter technique you used when you first started interviewing him about the casino business.
Sure. I met Trump in the early June of 1988 and immediately recognized, you know, this guy's an impressive promoter, and I thought of him as he's our P.T. Barnum, the guy who had the Fiji Mermaid and these other hoaxes.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the most important force in Atlantic City, so I start asking about him, and one of the state officials, a regulator, says to me, well, you know, Donald doesn't know anything about running a casino. And I said, what are you talking about? He owns two casinos. He doesn't know anything about it. The polite term was, Donald is not an operator. And I went and talked to other journalists in town, because I'm new, and I talked to some of his executives, and his other people around him, and they all said, oh, yeah, Donald doesn't know anything about the casino business. So with the help of somebody, I framed some questions about the games. The first one was about the game of craps, where we put in blatantly false statements, ridiculously false statements, not subtle fine points. And when I sat down for my first interview with Donald, I dropped these questions into the interview, and in each case, he embraced my falsehood in his answer. Well, you know, that's what those people do you hear in the TV ads. Hi, we're California psychics. We're the best psychics. You want to talk to your late grandmother or want to know if that man really loves you? Just call so-and-so psychics. He's a con artist.
Yeah. Well, the other people who do that, by the way, if you get phone salesmen on the phone with you.
Yes.
You know, so what's that copy machine? Is that the Sony you have? You know, and then when you tell them, they go, oh, no, right, you've switched to the Sharp, I know. And they take off from there.
Right. And Donald is very, very good at this, and nobody called him on his BS. I mean, at the time, back in 88, there was Wayne Barrett, who died recently, who was the first reporter to get on, about 9 years ahead of me, and me. And then there was briefly a reporter for the Wall Street Journal until Trump tricked him into doing something that he then used to force him to be to resign from the Wall Street Journal. He went on to make a fortune as a hedge fund manager, so don't worry about it. And you know, Donald was constantly threatening people. He called up one of my editors, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and said I was this horribly craven person who was constantly trying to get something from the casino. Everybody in the business who knows me knows that I'll take a glass of water or a cup of coffee from anybody because it's a courtesy. That's the end of it. I won't let you stamp my parking receipt.
Yeah.
And in your own building. And you know, the editor immediately realized this is ridiculous. But he would make life difficult for anybody who didn't toe the line.
Yeah, well, this one thing that, I mean, you're talking about the kinds of intimidation. The thing he's doing right now with Rosenstein, right? In other words, he implicates, that is to say, he directs Rosenstein to write the memo on why he should fire Comey. And now that Rosenstein is investigating him, you can tell the story better than I can, but it's this.
Well, here's what's interesting about this. One of the things Donald is very talented at is compromising investigations.
Exactly.
He got out of 4 grand jury investigations in his 30s. He got out of numerous investigations with the Casino Control Commission that should have cost him his license. He's very good at finding a vulnerable place with any kind of investigation so he can either run out the clock or muddy the waters. And in this case, what's really interesting is one of his lawyers, Jay Sekulow, was on Fox News this morning, the day we're talking, with Chris Wallace. And he twice says the president's under investigation after he did what was recommended by Rod Rosenstein, which is to fire him. And when Chris Wallace says, well, given the president's under investigation, and Sekulow goes, he's not under investigation. I never said that. And Wallace goes, you just said it twice. Donald creates his own reality, and his lawyers will say things that are outrageously untrue because it's simply a tactic to divert attention and get you to argue over that instead of the substance of the issue.
Mm-hmm. Very good, very good. Yeah, people will look at an accident, yeah, as you say. So, by the way, this is Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with David K. Johnston, and we're talking about Trump, the Trump administration, and a lot of the history of Trump as revealed in his book based on 27 years of reporting on and investigating Donald Trump. The book is called The Making of Donald Trump, and you can learn more at David K. Johnston's website, which you set up this website strictly to deal with information in the stuff we're talking about, and it's dcreport.com.
Well, let me just say it. DC, which is a play on District of Columbia, my name, David K.,
exactly,
or my editor's name, David Crook, yeah.
dcreport.org,
singular, yeah. dcreport, one word, .org. And what we do is we cover what the administration and Congress do. We don't cover the tweets. So we were the first to report the Republicans had this plan to give away federal lands. It was buried in an obscure document of the kind we go looking at every day. We were the first to report that Trump is setting things up to radically jack up the price of electricity. And then we've covered the follow-through since then of how he's doing this, and we'll have more in the near future. We reported on how they're hiding records, how they've They've taken actions absolutely inimical to the safety of workers. And we do this by covering the official government paperwork and explaining to you what it means. And news organizations don't do that. News organizations cover the controversy.
Right.
They cover the cheap stuff, the press conferences at the White House. We go cover what the government does, not what the politicians say.
How often are there new reports in the D.C. report, Doug?
Oh, 4 or 5 times a week. And we're trying to raise enough money. It's mostly a volunteer effort right now. I don't get paid even expenses. We've raised money from more than 1,000 donors who've sent us from $500 up to some thousands. But we're now trying to raise serious money so we can hire people, pay them real salaries, and show that, you know, boy, if we could husband $8,000 a month as well as we have, just think of what we could accomplish if we could spend $80,000 or $250,000 a month. We spend less per month on our news service than the New York Times spends per day covering Trump, and yet we've repeatedly broken stories that the Times either only later reported or didn't report at all.
Okay, so I'll tell you what, the next time that I read that list of organizations, I will also add DC Report as a way to not act in resistance, but learn what's going on.
Thank you.
What I'd like to shift now to is, and I'm going to ask you to keep them sort of brief, but just a few of the highlights of the history of Trump. First, philanthropy. Talk just a bit about his philanthropy, or lack thereof.
Oh, Trump calls himself an ardent philanthropist, but for many years, virtually all the money in the Donald J. Trump Foundation came from people doing business with him, the people who made his neckties and who booked sporting events that he was sponsoring, and they were basically legal kickbacks. And that would make perfect sense if Trump was paying no income taxes, because there's no tax benefit to him in making a donation, whereas he could get his business associates to do it. And the giving is completely undistinguished and heavily self-interested. Trump has given far more money to the private schools his children have gone to than he's directly donated himself in the last 20 years.
Okay. A quick history of the massive debts, multiple bankruptcies, bailouts, and so on.
Well, in 1990, Donald told me he was worth $3 billion. The same day he told ABC News $5 billion, which should tell you right there he just makes it up. But he couldn't pay his bills. And so when his bankers went to foreclose on him, he got the New Jersey Casino Control Commission to take his side against his bankers and to basically tell the bankers, if you want to foreclose, go right ahead. You'll have lovely hotels by the seaside, but you won't have casino licenses. Now, that's not how the law is supposed to work. The state's supposed to take over the licenses and find a new buyer. But Donald got the Casino Control Commission to do what he wanted. And he survived this. The bankers he owed over $3 billion to, and except for two relatively small loans, they were all outside of New Jersey banks, so it was easy for the politicians to go against the banks. The banks wrote the loans down by over $900 million, almost $1 billion. Trump then bought a tax shelter that allowed him to deduct the money, too. So the money was deducted twice, first by the banks and then by Trump. And when Congress learned about this tax shelter, they Republicans shut it down in a matter of weeks. I mean, they moved with lightning speed because they understood that double deducting things will ruin the tax system. And Trump is not a good businessman. He is a cash extractor. He gets his hands on an enterprise with no money in it. He never had a dollar invested in Atlantic City. It was all borrowed money. He then pulls cash out as fast as he can, and like a leech would do to you. And when the business is weakened because so much cash has been drained out of it, he sells it, he walks away from it, he cans the keys to the bank, and walks away. His casino company, he was the only publicly traded company he ever had. After his arrangement to get the banks to take a haircut, he created this publicly traded company. They sold stock at $35 a share and gave Donald millions of dollars worth of shares. He took at least $82 million out of that business over the next 13 years. It never made a profit. It reported losses of over $1 billion. They stiffed contractors and employees left and right while paying Donald 100 cents on the dollar. and they went through four bankruptcies while he was there, two bankruptcies after he left, and as they clean up the final deal, they may well file a seventh bankruptcy.
Wow. Let's shift now to his connections with the mob. Mm-hmm. Talk about that. And one of the things you point out in your book is let me just make one note. One thing you point out in your book is that when he was going through that negotiation with the Gaming Commission in New Jersey and the banks, he basically got himself viewed as a too big to fail kind of situation,
yes.
Right? That was the logic of why the bank should bail him out, was that if he went bankrupt, it would hurt Atlantic City too much. And so it's
right.
Just interesting, the irony of that.
Right. And of course, it would also force the regulators to acknowledge they never should have licensed him in the first place. As for his mob connections, his grandfather was a draft dodger from Germany who came here in the late 1800s and made a fortune running whorehouses in Seattle and Everett, Washington, and the Yukon Territory.
Including, as you point out, one that he built on land he didn't own.
That he even built a hotel, not a normal hotel for sleeping, on land he didn't own. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
His father, Fred Trump, was a very industrious guy, but he had a business partner, Willie Tomasello, who's identified in lots of law enforcement reports as a associate of the Gambino and Genovese crime families. Those are the two biggest crime families in New York. And Donald, as a young man, made a beeline to Roy Cohn, the notorious Roy Cohn, who was the attack dog for Senator Joseph McCarthy, and learned from him. He called Roy Cohn his second father and mm-hmm. his mentor, and it was Roy Cohn who taught him to always attack, never concede a mistake, muddy the waters, make up fantastically false things if they will advance your position in the expectation that the government's run by a bunch of wimps who will fold. And Donald, when he built Trump Tower, he got his concrete from S&A Concrete, which was owned by the head of the Gambino and the head of the Genovese crime family. He did the same thing with the Trump Plaza apartments on East 61st Street in Manhattan. He was involved with John Cody, the corrupt head of the Teamsters Union, and a whole variety of other people. And Donald's entire life, he's been involved with Russian mobsters, mafia, con artists, swindlers. His biggest casino, the Taj Mahal, in its first 18 months that it was opened in 1990 and 91, was found later to have engaged in at least 160 acts of money laundering.
Wow. Wow.
So he's a guy who just thumbed his nose at the law and got away with it.
Now, let me ask you this question. How might his ties to the mob be in play now that he's in the White House?
Well, I'm not so worried about his ties with the mafia. I'm much, much more worried about his ties with Russian mobsters. You know, there was a lot of news at the Mariel boat lift that Castro, when he let people leave, emptied out his prisons and sent all sorts of vicious criminals to America, which he did. Well, when the Russians were letting the Soviet Jews go and other people, they also encouraged their criminal classes to leave. And Donald, since at least 1987, has been seeking and doing business with Russians. And today, the Russian oligarchs are a government-sponsored network of international financial criminals. Vladimir Putin does not believe in democracy. He thinks it's a joke. He wants to rebuild the old Russian Empire, at least in the countries that are primarily Russian-speaking. The leaders of the three little Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, have told every journalist who will listen, we're afraid he's just going to roll in here with tanks and take us over. When men in uniform but with no insignia showed up in Crimea, Putin said, oh, those aren't our men at all. Those are local militia forces. Those are local people. He recently gave an interview where he said, well, of course they were my soldiers. And Donald Trump has at various times said he has a close relationship with Vladimir Putin, and on other occasions said he's never met him.
Right.
What we know is he has extensive financial dealings with the oligarchs who maintain their fortunes and their wealth only at the pleasure of Vladimir Putin. And there are two big deals that are too complicated for us to go into right now that essentially show that when Donald Trump gets into financial trouble, Vladimir Putin's friends, the oligarchs, bail Donald out. They make do deals that make no economic sense unless you're basically paying him off. And why do they do that? Because the Russians have a very long-term sense of how you compromise people in the West, you make friends, and hey, they hit the jackpot. Their friend is now the president.
Yep, yep. And let's fast forward then on that one while we're in it. And how is that in play now that Trump is in the White House? What does that have to do with Paul Manafort? What does that have to do with Michael Flynn? What are we perhaps ultimately going to learn?
Well, let me cut to the chase about that. We have to consider seriously the possibility, and I want to emphasize the word possibility, that the man now in the Oval Office is a traitor. And there's no other U.S. president you could possibly have even thought that about. Throughout the campaign, Donald Trump gratuitously praised Vladimir Putin as a great man. You just mentioned his name, and he would go into rhapsody about him. And I got out some, you can find these on the internet, transcripts of mafia soldiers who don't know they're being secretly surveilled. And you read, if someone brings up their boss, what they say, and they sound just like Donald Trump when he talks about Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, the one thing
boss, what a great guy. Oh, right. Terrific guy.
Right, but the one thing I would say to that, David,
because they don't want to get whacked.
But he says that about every authoritarian, Duterte.
Yeah, he did not go out of his way, though, to do it for anybody else. You bring up Duterte, he'll talk about him that way. But Donald went out of his way and often, making no sense, went off on these things about Putin.
Okay.
Now, Paul Manafort for 5 months was his campaign manager. Paul Manafort is a Washington operative who is the friend of violent dictators all around the world. When the pro-Moscow Ukrainian government was overthrown, and all these documents from the billion-dollar or half-billion-dollar presidential palace were thrown into an artificial lake, journalists trained by investigative reporters and editors, which I used to be the board chairman of, recognized that they needed to get those records right away and freeze them so they weren't destroyed. And people got scuba gear. They went into this lake in the bitter cold, and they recovered these records and froze them. And lo and behold, it shows Paul Manafort got $24 million. He says he didn't get it, but the ledgers say he did. He hires Michael Flynn as his national security advisor, a guy who was fired by Obama because people thought he was in way over his head, had no idea what he was doing. He'd been a very good general up to a point, and then he got into an area where he apparently was out of his depth, and he took $40,000 from Vladimir Putin's propaganda arm, Russia Today, and he has now registered retroactively as a foreign agent of Turkey. But in that case, the money actually came from a Russian oligarch. And general officers are not, in fact, officers, period, cannot take money from a foreign government without the permission of the United States. And he didn't get it. He lied about it. And we've seen all these other things that have been lied about and covered up on connections to the Russians, the conversations with Kislyak. None of this goes to the government in the Philippines, in China, in Mexico. They're all Russia. Russia, Russia, Russia. It's all Russia. And Trump is desperate to say there's no story there, and all of that should tell you there's a really big story there that he knows if it gets out, it's curtains for him as president.
Let me ask you a question about the whole thing, the relationship of, shall we call it, the Russian story, the Russian collusion story, the Russian blackmail story. There are many who will say that Democrats or the resistance or anything, if they pay too much attention to that story, they're missing the real stories of what's going on with the Affordable Care Act, what's going on with banking regulation, what's going on with so on. What's your feeling about that? Yeah,
that's
if you're doing
exactly
DCReport.org.
We created DC Report.
Yeah.
It's to cover what the government does. We're going to have stories in the next couple of days that we're working on now about things that nobody is writing about, will be writing about except us, at least initially, on things that they're doing. Basically, well, Trump is lazy and doesn't know how government works. I mean, his lack of understanding is just hard to fathom. You could be as ignorant as he is and be in the White House. Around him, he has loose termites who are going through the structure of the government, eating away at it. They are shutting down offices. They are telling scientists not to go and publish or go to conferences or to do their work. They are proposing huge cuts in data collection where once we get that restored someday, there'll be big holes in it. And it's not just data collection about climate science or about weather. And, of course, climate and weather are not the same thing at all. But it's things like public health. And so there's a legitimate and real concern that one has to pay attention to these things. And that's why we started DC Report. But I think the most important thing to pay attention to is that we have a manifestly unfit person with his finger on the nuclear button. I mean, Donald Trump is a man who didn't do a single day of public service in his entire life. He never even served on a mayor's advisory commission of any kind. He's a man who lies as easily as you and I breathe. You know, hundreds of my friends and my dear, lovely friends died on 9/11. Yeah, how many funerals you go to? Zero. We have to get these terrorists who are here in the country illegally out of the country. Number of people this year who have been moved for deportation because of doing something connected to a terrorist act, just a plot to do something, zero, not one. You know, people were dancing in the streets in New Jersey as the towers came down. Complete nonsense, just a complete made-up story.
So your sense, David, is that the Russian story is bigger than we know, perhaps. And
well, the big story is the money story about Trump's criminal connections and money, and it is deeply intertangled with the Russia story. And those two things together pose a real problem for Trump because the guy investigating him, Robert Mueller, a decorated officer and war hero, and I mean a real war hero if you go read about his record, a very brave man, he is a highly, highly competent lawyer and investigator and manager who knows both counterintelligence and white-collar crime. And if you look at the team that he has assembled to investigate Trump, it's about as good a team as exists anywhere in this country. Donald Trump is now under serious investigation by someone who knows what he's doing and has the thing I've never had, subpoena power.
Right. Now, so those people that say it's a distraction, what if we never find a smoking gun? We'll have kept our attention over there, and Trump will have been glad that we did because Ryan and McConnell and all those folks got to do what they wanted to do, by enabling him. You're saying both need to be paid attention to.
Correct. And you'll notice they're not getting anywhere with health care. I mean, the minute the Republicans change Obamacare, anything at all they do to change it, they own every woman who dies unnecessarily of breast cancer because she couldn't get treatment. They owe every father who dies because he couldn't afford to get his heart medication. They owe every child who dies. They own every single one of them, and they know that. And so the bill they're apparently working on in super secret in the Senate, where it's only, by the way, white, I think they're all white, but all males, no women involved, and they won't even tell fellow Republicans what they're doing.
Yep.
Apparently, their plan is to really make tremendous cuts in 2022.
Mm.
Their idea being they will have such a hold on government by then that it doesn't matter that people will die left and right when they lose their health care.
Well, and also some of them won't be in office, so they've protected their...
And that's right. And here's an important point I really want to get across to people. If we had the French health care system, widely regarded as the best in the world, no out-of-pocket costs, and you see a doctor immediately, I mean, very right away, but even better than here in the U.S., and they have better health outcomes than we do, it would save an amount of money equal to eliminating the income tax for 99.3% of Americans. Now, it doesn't literally work that way, but just think about how much money you paid in income tax last year, and unless you are making over $700,000 a year, you would not pay any income tax, in effect.
And that's in
that's how much money we would save.
That's how much we would save by getting rid of the inefficiencies in
for-profit sick care system that uses superfluous. You know, all the debate and discussion on TV is about health insurance. I don't care about health insurance.
Yeah.
Do you care about health insurance? I care about health care.
Hey, we both have Medicare.
Well, actually, I'm not on Medicare because my wife's an executive and she's still working. But it's coming.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, quickly on this one. How much money did Trump make on the presidential campaign?
He made a profit on it in various ways. He was able to charge off all the use of his jet, and by federal law, he had to charge a price to the campaign for the use of the jet that includes a profit. He's not required to account for it, but I think he got $6 or $7 million is the number in my head, and if that's the case, the profit on that should have been 10-20%. So figure somewhere between $600,000 and $1 million profit. They rented hotel rooms left and right, and Secret Service and others did from his properties. And he's making a lot of money right now by being president. When the Secret Service, when he wants to play golf, follows him around in golf carts, he charges them for the golf carts.
Yep. That was going to be my second question. How much is he making now? And he's making plenty because he keeps using his own.
Price to join Mar-a-Lago after the election.
Right.
One thing we do know from the financial disclosure he just issued is, remember, he claimed he was worth $8.7 billion, and then 10, and then more than 10, and then 11 back in 2015.
It's more like 3,
well,
isn't it?
Well, this document makes it pretty clear that he's worth maybe $1.4 to $2 billion, but
debts.
He says his golf course in Palos Verdes is worth more than $50 million. He's claimed in the past $250 million, but he has it on the L.A. County tax rolls at $10 million. He claims another golf course here on the East Coast is worth more than $50 million. He's talked about it, I think, in the neighborhood of $100 million, but he wants it to be on the tax rolls at $7.5 million. So there's another area where Donald just makes it up.
Yep, yep. What do you make of the suits filed by Maryland and the District of Columbia over the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution?
I think there are three places where the Emoluments Clause appears in the Constitution. Most of the focus has been on the third one. I think he's got real problems with the second, which is in Article 2. And that's one of many, many lawsuits going on against Trump, also efforts to unseal records about his conduct in the past, because Donald seals everything. And if investigators can break through the non-disclosure agreements that everyone around him signs, including all the women he has dalliances with, I think they can turn up a great deal about him. But I think all this litigation is a real problem for him, because the Emoluments Clause is very clear. The founders of this country, the framers of our Constitution, who are not the same people, they knew their history. They knew that there had been, for instance, British kings on the payroll of the French,
mm-hmm.
and who were disloyal to their country, and that's why that clause is there. And they also were worried about corruption, not in the venal sense of bribes, but institutional corruption. And that's why the Emoluments Clause is there. So I think that's all of these suits by Crew, by the attorneys general, and the other actions are going to tie up Trump, put his agenda in trouble, and add to the case that he's committed high crimes and misdemeanors.
Mm-hmm. So that's I think these are very slow ticking time bombs, right?
Exactly. It takes, you know, Watergate, from the burglary to the day Richard Nixon resigned, was 26 months. And he had a hostile Democratic Congress.
That's right. Okay, you've written a great deal about taxes before.
Yep.
You know, you've covered Trump for years, but taxes has really been, you know, the thing, your go-to thing. What are the tax implications? This is a question, again, we need a quick answer for, but the tax implications of the Republican health care bill and the proposed Republican tax bill, and what do you think are their prospects of passage?
Okay, the Republicans have a very clear economic plan. The rich don't have nearly enough, and they have a plan to get it for them. They're going to take health care away from middle class, working class, and poor people. They're going to take benefits away from the sick, from the disabled, from children, from the elderly, to redistribute it to the rich. They talk about how much they hate redistribution of income, but in fact, the record shows they love redistribution of income when it takes money out of the pockets of ordinary people in ways they don't see directly and puts it in the pockets of the billionaire class. Trump will sign any bill they'll put in front of him, but I think they've got the real practical political problems with health care and tax reform, which are intertwined. The idea they're calling tax reform and are uncritically sometimes recounted on the networks as
mm-hmm.
tax reform,
yep.
it's just more tax cuts for the rich.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Republicans are very clear. Their goal is very clear. You know, they believe in the Leona Helmsley view that only little people should pay taxes.
Mm-hmm. And or the Trump view that I'm smart not to.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And the one year, you know, I remember I got his 2005 tax return.
Right.
And went on Rachel Maddow after we'd posted it at DC Report. That's where we broke the story, that he paid the $31 million, $36 million of taxes that year. Well, $35 million of it was a refundable alternative minimum tax that he probably got back over the next couple of years. That's why I think that's the return I got, which I suspect came from Trump or someone at Trump's direction, because it made him look like he had a high income and paid a lot of taxes. But I've always thought it's an anomalous return.
Mm-hmm. That they cherry-picked the one that would make him look the best, even
exactly.
though, as you point out, it put him at paying tax at the same rate as someone who made $400,000.
If it hadn't been for the alternative minimum tax, which he wants to get rid of, he would have paid taxes at a lower rate than the poorest half of Americans. He would have paid less than a 3.5% rate under his tax plan if it were in effect.
Okay. Final question, and you got a minute and a half. Despite his unique qualities and the consequences, I suspect you'll agree that Trump is an effect, a symptom, not a cause. What's the underlying story here that made a Trump presidency possible?
Well, Terrence, this is particularly ironic for me. I wrote a trilogy of books you mentioned earlier, Perfectly Legal, Free Lunch, The Fine Print, that were designed to explain why the 90% of Americans have seen their income go nowhere from 1966 till 2012. And, you know, I don't expect most people to read those books, even though they were bestsellers. But I showed how government policies nobody knew about did this, how your taxes are being diverted from the schools to subsidize General Electric and Walmart and Warren Buffett and Donald Trump, one of the biggest welfare kings in America. And what people know is that it's been virtually a half century, and their incomes haven't gone anywhere. From 66 to 2012, the average income of 90% of Americans went up by inflation plus one penny on the dollar.
Oh, my God.
They went nowhere. Whereas at the top, we literally have people in America with his and her private jumbo jets.
Mm-hmm.
Donald never read my books. He doesn't read anybody's books. But he intuitively understood there was a huge portion of the population saying, what's happened here? My job is insecure. I'm living paycheck to paycheck. I'm in debt. And he exploited that. He said, I alone can save you. I will protect you. And I'm going to bring back steelworkers' jobs and stop this dumping of steel, even as he was using Chinese steel to build his own buildings. I'm going to see to it that we don't have foreign workers taking jobs of Americans, even as he was turning away Americans and hiring people on visas to work at Mar-a-Lago.
Tell you what, we've got to wrap it up. When will we see your book on what we're just talking about now?
Oh, probably 2 years, because I'm doing another Trump book now called
okay.
The Trump Factor. It'll be out in January, and it'll be another year or so, and I'll do the prosperity tax, a whole new tax system for the 21st century.
Very good. So the website is dcreport.org. The book we've been talking about is The Making of Donald Trump. Thank you, David K. Johnston. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencmcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, to the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements of upcoming guests and issues, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. You can find years of podcasts at my site, terrencemcnally.net, or at iTunes. Listen anytime, anywhere. And thanks to Gary Baca, my engineer, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely.